Welcome to the Flow Tracy Money Audio Commentary. This is Owen Tracy recording. It's 1:44 p.m. this Pacific Summer Time. Today is April 2nd. We had a big move in oil today with President Trump reaching out to both the Russian and Saudi Arabian administrations. He announced that there's going to be a supply cut, but Russia was very swift to shoot back and say that they're not going to cut supply, and Saudi Arabia is anxious to set up a meeting with OPEC Plus, but of course it's not Plus any longer, it's OPEC Plus, 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 because they want to negotiate with Russia, the USA, Canada, Brazil, Mexico, because the simple fact of the matter is that a non-OPEC supply is now a very substantial proportion of global supply, and a large number of OPEC members are heavily dependent on high oil prices to balance their budgets. So they want to develop a global discussion about what a fair price is for oil, and that of course raises the potential of a global cartel. And how incentivized are the non-OPEC producers going to be to fall in with that? Because in a free market environment, we get a massive decline, just like we've just had, where the strong try to push out the weak, and the lowest cost producer eventually wins out. That is potentially something that national oil companies can make decisions about, because they have control over all of national production. It is not something that the USA or Canada is going to have an easy time doing, because production is very much controlled by the private sector. So that is one of the reasons why the price wasn't able to hold all of the gain in here today. But perhaps the most important point is that it has now broken its sequence of lower rally highs. And we're starting to see that not only has it broken the sequence of lower rally highs, but some of the largest oil companies with the biggest dividend yields are beginning to exhibit some signs of finding at least near-term support. So Exxon has rallied from 30 to 40 over the course of the last 10 sessions. Its yield was as high as 11% at the bottom, and it is still really very high, particularly in an environment where government bond yields are in single digits. Chevron has also bounced impressively from just over $50 to almost $80. And Royal Dutch Shell, which had experienced a really exaggerated decline, has rallied from 1,000 to 1,500p. So we've definitely seen some short covering coming through in the oil sector, particularly for those companies that have got the big chunky dividends. And Royal Dutch Shell, for example, currently yields almost 10%, and it was north of 11%. In fact, I think it was upwards of 14% at one point last week. Well, it's not beyond the bounds of possibility that some of these energy companies will have to cut their dividends. But particularly for companies like Exxon and Chevron, they don't have a lot of debt. So it's not going to be debt issues that are going to stop them from paying their dividend. But they may have to borrow money in order to engage in M&A activity, because there are certainly going to be bankruptcies in the high-yield sector. High-yield energy is now still in the region of about 2,000 basis points, and that is substantially above where it was when oil bottomed in 2016 and from back in 2008, and both of those occurrences were coincided with bankruptcies in the highly levered part of the debt sector. On the other side of that, you have the investment-grade sector. Now, the investment-grade ETFs pulled back in an incredibly dramatic fashion 2 weeks ago, and they have subsequently rebounded, not least because, on the one hand, we're starting to see new issues coming through. Investment-grade companies are issuing new debt, and it is being bought with a great deal of enthusiasm by investors, for the simple reason that pension funds and investors, they still need to capture a yield, and That is regardless of anything else that happens. A pension fund still has money that it has to invest. It has to try and capture the highest yield it can. And the investment grade sector is getting a very significant tailwind from central banks, not just the Federal Reserve, buying investment grade bonds. So it has rebounded in really quite impressive fashion, right back up towards the region of the trend mean. And this is obviously a natural area now where we might anticipate some pause in consolidation. By and large, when I talk about the trend mean, it is in regard to the 200-day moving average. I have also been talking about the 1,000-day moving average because it is a trend smoothing device for very long-term trends in terms of secular trends, and it's particularly relevant today when a number of those stock market indices are trading below their 1,000-day moving averages. What is particularly relevant, I think, is to compare the performance of the investment grade ETFs with the high yield ETFs. The high yield ETF has certainly bounced, but has not recouped more than 50% of the decline, and it is still a long way from the region of the trend mean. And there is obviously here clear potential that without the support coming through from central bank purchases, that there is a clear risk that we're going to see the high yield spreads continuing to expand. And the spread right now is still around 900 basis points. It was 1,000 basis points last week, but it hasn't really come down in any kind of measurable fashion. And we definitely know that there are going to be highly levered companies that are under a great deal of stress right now and are quite likely that they are going to have difficulties meeting bond payments, and that does raise the potential for defaults. Now, we've definitely seen that there's been some forbearance measures in terms of leases for companies. We've also seen a really concerted effort to try and support companies, and also these small business loans that are forgivable if companies don't fire their workers. These are important considerations, quite outside of the additional money that is getting sent out to consumers. And that is something that could help the high yield sector as well. But the longer we see that the economies of the world are just locked down and we have this economic hiatus, well, then the longer that is going to, I think, put upward pressure on yields, particularly high yield bonds. Now, when we then think about the effect that the pop on the oil price had on the stock market, well, the S&P 500 was able to unwind most of the decline that it had in trading yesterday, although it did not unwind the initial drop. Now, at least it is not coming down on consecutive days. I think it is quite likely that we're going to see some pause in consolidation. And when I look at the fact that it has not yet been able to push back above the 1,000-day moving average, and the 1,000-day moving average does tend to offer support during secular bull markets, I think that's one of the more important points, that it was a rivetingly consistent point of reference in the secular bull market from the early 1980s all the way through until the acceleration phase in the late 1990s. It was also a particularly relevant consideration during the very lengthy bull market that led up to the peaks in the 1960s. So when we think about where are we now in terms of the overall trend, well, the minimum requirement now is that we get the index back above the 1,000-day moving average. If we continue to see ranging below it, then we don't have much choice than to conclude that we've got a complete top formation. If the index can simply put in a few weeks underneath the 1,000-day moving average and then start to put in higher reaction lows, well, then that will certainly help to, I think, support the view that support building is underway and that the improvement in valuations against a background of extraordinary assistance from central banks is likely to result in higher asset prices. But in order for that conclusion to be reached, we're at least going to have to see higher reaction lows. And I think it is still quite likely that we're going to see a retest of the lows or a more pronounced pullback in order to flush out some of the weaker holders and to ensure that the central banks are willing to do literally whatever it takes. That determination has not yet been tested, and it is likely to be tested before investors have more confidence that there is a clear support mechanism underneath the market right now. When we look at the gold price, it has certainly done better with oil prices starting to firm up, and it was up $21 in here today, continuing to hold the region of the $1,600 area, and this does look like still a consolidation. Silver prices having pulled back in a much more dramatic fashion at the beginning of, or in the middle of March, were up 66 cents in here today, and still looking like a process of mean reversion is underway. It's a very similar condition for the gold miners. And gold miners, however, have rebounded more impressively and have pretty much fully unwound the overextension relative to the trend mean. We're not going to have clear confirmation that we're back in a demand-dominated environment until it is consolidating above the trend mean. That will probably take a little while. We've replaced a short-term oversold condition with a short-term overbought condition, so some consolidation is not at all beyond the bounds of possibility. But I think one of the big determinations for the outlook for the gold mining sector is how well they're going to be able to sustain their production against the pressure for lockdowns in the countries that they are active in. Agnico Eagle did announce in here today that they're going to be slowing down production in Mexico as a result of a lockdown order there. Highland Gold they announced in here today that they haven't experienced any problems with production because their mines are so remote, and that share, having been volatile, is still very close to the region of the peaks put in earlier on in the year and is one of the higher yielding of the major gold producers. So one thing that's, I think, rather interesting is that there are over 1,100 gold or precious metal miners listed on Bloomberg, but only about 100 of them pay dividends. And of those, a considerably smaller number have impressive dividend growth numbers. And it is dividend growth is something that I think gold investors will be particularly interested in over the next few years, particularly against a low interest rate environment and with a bull market for gold. A number of those gold miners that do produce dividends have tied the size of the dividend to the gold price. Gold miners are still likely to be among the most likely sectors to beat analyst estimates when first quarter results are announced later this month. The guidance on how well they can sustain production against the background of lockdowns being ordered in different countries is probably going to be the determining factor on how well the shares in fact do. What I think is interesting, however, is in the gold mining sector, where we've had in the most part reasonably modest pullbacks, the Australian sector has pulled back much more aggressively. Newmont Mining, for example, has more than halved over the course of the last while, and or just about halved, I should say. When it has a part of the reason for that was because of production guidance that was somewhat disappointing, but it is now starting to exhibit some relative strength and beginning to unwind, or at least put in some support around the 20 Australian dollar level. But it's the commonality that we see in some of the Australian gold miners having been the clear outperformers in from 2018 onwards. They are now exhibiting relative weakness. So there is obviously something that is weighing on those companies in the short term. It's certainly not the gold price, but it may be the Australian dollar. The collapse we've had in the Australian dollar has probably sapped international interest in Australian miners. But the retreat in the Australian dollar should have been something that would flatter the price of gold. And the collapse in oil should also have flattered the cost of production. So that is, I think, one of the idiosyncrasies of the market, that we've had weakness in the gold sector in Australia, but not a particularly strong reason for why that might be the case. Now, the Australian dollar has rebounded, and it has been a little weaker over the course of the last 4 days. It looks like nothing more than a consolidation. It still has a very wide oversold condition on particularly relative to the trend mean, but I think it is likely we're going to see the 55-cent level hold for a while. The dollar was a little stronger in here today, particularly versus the euro. The pound was pretty much unchanged, but the euro was pulling back in a rather dynamic manner. One of the adages that David coined years ago was that there is no country wants a strong currency, but some need a weaker currency more than others, and that is certainly true of Europe right now. So the weak euro has been a tailwind for European equities. The DAX index was in positive territory in here today. The FTSE 100 was also up in here today, and the FTSE has got one of the highest dividends of any stock market index anywhere. Sorry, I'm not typing especially effectively, but we can see the yield on the description page, sorry about that, which is 5.86%. In an environment where we have extraordinarily low interest rates and a clear requirement for some, I think, yield from investors for total returns that are flattered by dividends in the broad perspective. That all suggests that we are eventually going to start to see interest coming through into these higher yielding sectors. When we think about the government bond sector, 10-year treasury yields, they're still positive, but they're down to less than 60 basis points. There is obviously a clear uncertainty still being priced into this market. Then there is the copper gold ratio. Copper was in positive territory in here today, and it is continuing to firm around the $2 area. As a major sign of strength or weakness in the global economy, the fact that copper has not exceeded the lows put in 2015, I think, is a rather positive phenomenon. The renminbi was also in slightly positive territory in here today, so not breaking down. That's also a comforting development. The A-share index in China was also in positive territory. there is the potential that we are approaching the nadir of the sell-off, or that at least we've got lows of near-term significance. There is, I think, still the likelihood that it's going to take time because we don't know exactly how bad the news is going to be. But I think it is likely that we are going to see the peak in infections at some point this month, that things will be better in May, that we'll start to see economies opening up again towards the end of May, and that the biotechnology sector is going to be working full speed to try and develop a vaccine. The number of treatments that are evolving, whether that is Gilead's remdesivir, or whether it is the evolution of dual treatments using the previous treatments for malaria. I've also seen, and it was a subscriber had actually suggested that vitamin C is something that has also been used for an awfully long time in treating coronaviruses, and that people are just getting IVs of vitamin C in hospitals. All of these factors are very suggestive that we are going to avoid a second wave. One thing that I find particularly interesting is that it is the consensus that there will be a second wave of infections, because the parallels that people are quoting with the Spanish flu influenza 100 years ago are quite relevant in many respects, except for the fact that technological innovation is completely different today. Now, when we think about what are the best performing sectors right now, then the NASDAQ 100 was in positive territory again in here today. And so far, it is holding the region around 7,500. If it can further improve from here, this may be the first higher reaction low. And certainly, we cannot conclude that after one day. But it certainly does hold out the possibility that that might be the case. There was obviously a massive surge in the number of unemployed people in here today. The most recent figure was for an additional 6.6 million people filing for jobless claims. And even when we put that on a logarithmic scale chart, it's still a ridiculously large number. It also helps to highlight just where the pressures are in the economy. And this is something that is going to be a key uncertainty. It's not about how many people have lost their jobs, but it is how quickly are they going to be able to go back to those jobs? How many companies are going to be willing to hire back the same number of people that they fired? And how many small businesses will in fact be able to reopen again? It's almost certain that we're going to see a very significant pop on the upside in terms of new jobs being taken up once we exit the lockdown phase, which will probably be sometime in the middle or the late part of May. But and that could easily take the jobless figures way back down. We could even see multiple percentages of unemployment figures coming back down again. But it is very unlikely that the number of unemployed is going to come back down at the same pace that it went up. And that means that we can anticipate that there will be lower growth, and that company earnings will have a meaningful impact, and not just for one quarter. But the more quarters we go on, the faster that hiring will pick back up, and not least because we're still in a zero interest rate environment. And bargains are already starting to come out, not just in the stock market, but the price of used cars is coming down, so that will help to stoke demand. Property prices may also moderate, at least in the very minimum, at least temporarily. And with low interest rates, then that will also help to stoke demand. So once people have more uncertainty, then that, or excuse me, have more certainty, that will contribute to greater willingness to take investment risks and personal risks with one's finances. But it doesn't obviate the clear risk that there will be recession and that the recession is going to be deep. But the most important point is that the stock market is forward-looking. And we've already seen that I think the dividend aristocrats in particular pulled back more violently than the wider market. But people are not about to stop drinking Coca-Cola or Pepsi. They're not about to stop eating McDonald's. And these companies are still among the most likely to continue to rebound, and not because of the size of their dividends, but rather because of the dividend growth, because these companies have never cut their dividends. And in an environment where there's a lot of uncertainty and interest rates are so very low and likely to stay low for a prolonged period, then dividend growth is something that is, I think, important from a macro perspective. In the event that we, in fact, do eventually get inflation, then that is also something that investors will really pay attention to, is dividend growth. When we then think about what is likely in terms of the emerging markets, I believe investors are unlikely to come back to the emerging markets in an aggressive manner until we see clear evidence that the dollar's rally has ended, and we're probably not there just yet. There's also a lot of speculation about what the massive quantities of money that Japanese life insurance companies have to invest is going to have on various other assets. The yen has been reasonably steady over the course of the last couple of days. The Nikkei has pulled back in a very violent manner, and it was in negative territory yesterday. It's quite likely to be at least bouncing in here tomorrow. But the problem that the major or the large cap sectors have is that their outperformance is very acute relative to small caps and mid caps. That's particularly acute in the in Japan, where the second section continues to outperform. When we look at the S&P 600, then the size of the rally has been really quite unimpressive, and so far the rebound has been modest in scale. When we look at the FTSE 250 in the UK, well, then also the rebound has been modest in scale. And it is in those smaller companies where the most acute risks reside. It's exactly the same point that we have with the continuing spread between investment grade and high yield widening. In fact, if we look at that spread, it really does make the point rather well. And I've sent myself that chart, so it might just be easier to pull it up. High yield has been underperforming in a very acute manner relative to investment grade, and that's just simply in the bond markets. But it's also true in the equity markets. The small cap shares and mid caps generally tend to be lower on the grading scale, and they're not getting the same quantity of assistance from government programs. So that is where the risk is being concentrated right now. Whereas when we look at companies like Google, it is certainly feeling the pressure from smaller companies shutting down operations, and they're not buying the same number of ads, for example. But when we then think about, well, what is the risk in terms of debt? Well, Google practically doesn't have debt. It's only about 7% or 8% of its equity, and it's trading on a price to sales ratio of less than 5. So it's not an expensive company. That doesn't mean that the price can't just do nothing for a while. But when people are looking for a port in a storm, when they're thinking about where the risks reside, then it's in these investment grade issues, particularly those that pay dividends and grow their dividends, that I think the focus of attention will reside. Because the risks that are outstanding in the smaller companies, I think, is it is just not worth taking at this point. And in the meantime, gold prices continue to offer a safe haven against the clear intention of central banks to devalue their way out of trouble. And I think with that, I'll leave you for today and wish all the best to all of you.